The headlines this hour: South Korea's new president calls Pyongyang's weapons programs a threat to global security and calls for the complete denuclearization of the North. Sri Lanka deploys thousands of troops to enforce a nationwide curfew, one day after deadly protests over an unprecedented economic crisis. And clashes erupt between police and protesters in a rally against alleged electoral fraud in the Philippines presidential polls. Warm welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. South Korea's new president wants the neighboring North to be completely denuclearized because its weapons pose a threat to global security. The newly inaugurated president, Yoon Suk-yeol, says the South is prepared to resolve this threat through dialogue. According to Yoon, Seoul is willing to offer an audacious plan to help boost the economy of North Korea if Pyongyang moves towards nuclear disarmament. Yoon made the remarks during his inauguration speech in Seoul. Tensions are high on the Korean Peninsula, with the North starting a new push to advance its nuclear and missile program. Pyongyang says its weapons act as a deterrent against U.S.-led threats in the region. From Seoul, our correspondent Jennifer Chang explains if North Korea is likely to trust the South, given their sour relations and the dismal experience of previous negotiations.
The speech today was clearly aimed at getting North Korea to completely and irreversibly denuclearize. And it was attended by a very high-level delegation from the U.S. with the second gentleman, Douglas Emhoff, Vice President Kamala Harris's husband, attending. It's really dismal. The North does not trust South Korea at all, the new president, anymore, because the South Koreans, they elected this new president just by 0.73 percentage points. And this new president, he said that he is going to bring tactical U.S. nuclear weapons to South Korea. That's a threat against North Korea. He also said he would preemptively attack North Korea if he thought North Korea was going to attack first with, say, a hypersonic missile. Well, experts say, how is he going to know that North Korea is going to do a suicidal thing by shooting off a hypersonic missile at South Korea? Many experts say that is not fitting for a presidential candidate to say something like that. He has a lot of controversy surrounding him. He's not even able to reorganize his government.
Sri Lanka imposes a nationwide curfew after seven people are killed in the latest wave of protests over an unprecedented economic crisis gripping the nation. The situation has been volatile in the country for weeks amid mostly peaceful protests, but violence flared Monday after supporters of Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa were bussed into the capital, Colombo, and attacked protesters with sticks and clubs. Nearly 200 people were wounded in the violence. Rajapaksa later resigned, but even that failed to calm public anger. The military had to rescue him after protesters stormed his official residence overnight, with police firing tear gas and warning shots to push back the crowd. Thousands of troops and police are now deployed in Colombo to enforce the curfew. The protests began several weeks ago over an economic crisis unseen in Sri Lanka since its independence in 1948. On to the Philippines. Manila has become the scene of confrontations between Filipino police and protesters who are opposed to the presidential election results. The demonstrators gathered outside of the Election Commission, claiming irregularities in the polls. Initial results showed that the son of the late dictator, Ferdinand Marcos, has won by a landslide. With over 95% of the ballots counted, the 64-year-old candidate has garnered almost 30 million votes, more than double that of his nearest rival, Vice President Lenny Robredo. The official results are expected toward the end of this month. 10 candidates have entered the race to succeed President Rodrigo Duterte. Today marks the first anniversary of Israel's 11-day bloody bombardment of Gaza, which claimed the lives of more than 260 Palestinians, leaving the enclave in ruins. In the following report, we take a closer look at last year's devastating war on the besieged Palestinian territory.
Gaza left in ruins following 11 days of Israeli attacks on the besieged Palestinian territory. Palestinians breathed a sigh of relief from Israeli attacks after a ceasefire came into force on May the 21st. cities and towns were heavily pounded by Israeli artillery and warplanes, even at night. Horror and panic go on. Some call their loved ones' names. Others rush them to hospital. And many more grieving for their loved ones. This girl is crying as relatives are carrying the body of her 11-year-old brother, Hossein Hamad, to gravesite. This man and his baby are the only survivors of their family of seven. The baby boy, Omar, was pulled alive from under the rubble after an overnight Israeli airstrike hit the Shati refugee camp in the northern Gaza Strip. At the same hospital, 6-year-old Susie was reunited with her father. Susie was rescued after she had been trapped for 7 hours under the ruins of their home. Her mother and 4 siblings lost their lives. The Israeli attacks took a heavy toll on civilians and caused widespread devastation. But life goes on. Fears of a new outbreak of conflict is there too, as tensions simmer from time to time over Israel's continued occupation of Palestinian land.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah denounces calls for the resistance movement's disarmament. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says the group's opponents want to turn the upcoming parliamentary election into a political war. Addressing a gathering in Beirut, Nasrallah rejected calls by some political actors for Hezbollah to be disarmed. He said those advocating disarmament want to sell the country to the U.S. and leave Lebanon exposed to Israel. The Hezbollah leader said those opposing the movement want Lebanon to forsake its most significant tool that can help the country drill national resources in its territorial waters. Nasrallah said resistance is ready to help the government extract offshore oil and gas resources, which can easily mitigate the ongoing economic crisis.
You have a resistance, a courageous resistance, a strong resistance, a capable resistance that can tell the enemy, which works day and night on drilling and removing all the natural resources in the disputed areas. We tell the enemy, if you prohibit Lebanon, then we will prohibit you. Yes, we are capable of prohibiting the Israelis from drilling their natural resources. We have the courage, we have the strength, and we have the capabilities. And I assure you, and I guarantee this, not one single company would dare to come to Karish area or anywhere in the disputed area if Hezbollah declared a clear threat and a clear warning in this area.
Nasrallah stressed that those calling for disarming Hezbollah are ignorant of Israeli threats. He cited Israeli massacres in southern Lebanon, including a mass killing in the village of Hula in 1948. Nasrallah said the Lebanese people resorted to resistance, realizing that the government neglected its responsibility to protect them. He said the resistance secured southern Lebanon, brought self-confidence among the people, and defeated the so-called Project of Greater Israel. Nasrallah urged people to vote for the resistance group in the upcoming elections, saying there is no hope for resolving Lebanon's problems without Hezbollah. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, joined us earlier with further insight into Sayed Hassan Nasrallah's latest speech.
Well, what's significant about this speech is that not just only the fact that it is an electoral campaign rally, but basically he is rebuffing everything that the foes of Hezbollah have been campaigning for. They have been calling for the disarmament of the resistance, and specifically, of course, Hezbollah, saying the fact that, for example, the resistance can disarm. It has liberated most of Lebanon's south, the occupied areas, and what's left should be done through international community and so on. But what Sayed Nasrallah said today, and as usual, of course, his speeches are very much logical, you can say academic, actually, presenting evidence, presenting historical facts of how everything that they are saying is not true. He totally showed, gave evidence of how the people of South Lebanon had always been suffering against Israel, even before there was a resistance, and that the Israeli invasion against Lebanon was not a bond to any of the struggling forces or the resistance armed forces that were present in Lebanon. Lebanon, that in South Lebanon, that they began after 1978, the first Israeli invasion against South Lebanon. So that mainly is very significant part, which basically shows with evidence and statements that those foes of Hezbollah who are saying that the resistance, there is no longer need for the resistance, but he stressed once more that as long as the Israeli threat remains, then therefore Lebanon cannot uncover itself.
The European Parliament has established a committee of inquiry into allegations that an Israeli software has been used by 15 nations to spy on at least 50,000 individuals. EU lawmakers are furious that the European Commission is refusing to set up its own investigation. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
Israel has sold its Pegasus software to dozens of countries around the world, which allows spies to easily hack into mobile phones and retrieve personal data. Apparently, very high-profile individuals have been targeted. Now, the PEGA committee inside the European Parliament has been set up to investigate.
We cannot overemphasize the severity of this scandal. When this kind of spyware is used against innocent citizens, whether they're journalists, activists, lawyers, businessmen or politicians, then regardless where in the European Union or even beyond.
The European Commission has been slated for refusing to take action against Tel Aviv for failing to rein in Israel's NSO company, which produces Pegasus.
This is about the accountability of the European Commission to the European citizens and to the European Parliament. You have a duty to investigate.
EU Commissioner Johannes Hahn told lawmakers it's a matter for national governments.
Mr. Commissioner, if you say it's member states in charge, would you mind telling me which member state is actually in charge of investigating in this and protecting us?
EU countries Poland and Hungary have been heavily criticised for buying the spyware from Israel. But one lawmaker says the bloc turned a blind eye when it was revealed in 2019 that Germany was spying on its allies.
Do not be a hypocrite. Do not point Poland and Hungary. Point everyone. Because who was in charge of German government? Madam Merkel. You were shaking in front of Merkel. Everyone was silent.
There was even a commissioner saying, oh, haha, I have a very boring life. There's nothing on my phone.
Experts say the it's fine, I have nothing to hide argument doesn't hold water.
At the heart of liberalism is saying exactly the contrary. You always need to hide and to have an umbrella against the eye of the state.
The European Parliament's PEGA committee is due to conclude its inquiry in 11 months from now. Already there is a great deal of scepticism that the EU will take any action against Israel regardless of the findings. After all, it has always shied away from doing so in the past. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Russia's chief negotiator in peace talks with Ukraine says the negotiations have not stopped and are being held remotely. Vladimir Medinsky also dismissed the possibility of in-person talks anytime soon, saying, quote, more specifics are needed for their resumption. Russian and Ukrainian negotiators last held face-to-face peace talks on March 29. Since then, they have been meeting by video link. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has set conditions for re-entering peace talks with Russia. They include the restoration of pre-war borders and the return of thousands of Ukrainian refugees evacuated to Russia. Moscow accuses Kyiv of stalling the talks and using reports of alleged atrocities committed by Russian troops to undermine negotiations. Russia's war in Ukraine started in late February to, quote, demilitarize and denazify the country. Kyiv and its Western allies say the offensive was unprovoked and unjustified. French President Emmanuel Macron has called for a negotiated truce between Russia and Ukraine, saying the humiliation of Russia does not help peace efforts.
Mais nous aurons demain.
We will have a peace to build tomorrow. Let us never forget that. I mentioned this earlier. We will have to do this with Ukraine and Russia around the table. The end of the discussion and the negotiation will be set by Ukraine and Russia, but it will not be done in denial, nor in exclusion of each other, nor even in humiliation.
Macron, however, dashed Ukraine's hopes for a swift admission to the European Union in a joint presser with the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. He said that it would take decades for a candidate, like Ukraine, to join the bloc. Macron also suggested building a wider political club beyond the EU that could also include Britain. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has repeatedly requested EU membership after Russia launched a war on his country in late February. Moscow is strongly opposed to Kyiv joining the bloc. Russia has celebrated May 9th, which marks the 77th anniversary of the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II, with a massive military parade. Addressing the event, President Vladimir Putin said the expansion of NATO is a direct threat to Moscow, accusing the West of plotting to invade Russian land. Our correspondent, Marina Kortanova, has more from the Russian capital.
Victory Day is celebrated on May 9th in Russia as one of the most important holidays in the country, as it marks the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union. An estimated 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians were killed in the Second World War, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War, or the holiday with tears in the eyes. This year's celebrations come at a time when Russia's relations with the West are at their lowest level. NATO countries openly supply Ukraine with weapons and conduct military exercises along Russian borders. In his speech at the parade, Russian President Vladimir Putin talked about the ongoing attempts in the world to justify the crimes of the Nazis, recalled the actions of NATO in Ukraine, and explained the reasons for the military action in Donbas.
Страна НАТО не захотели нас услышать.
The NATO countries did not want to hear us, which means that in fact they had completely different plans, and we saw it. Openly, preparations were underway for another punitive operation in the Donbas, an invasion of our historical lands, including Crimea.
Putin has defended the offensive against Ukraine, describing it as a preemptive measure. And after the traditional military parade on Red Square, the president led the People's Parade. Starting 2015, the Immortal Regiment Parade is held in hundreds of Russian-inhabited localities from Kaliningrad to Vladivostok and in other countries. It became the most significant emotional event, as there is no family that has remained unaffected in Russia. All who remember and honor their own veterans of the army and navy, partisans, resistance fighters, home front combatants, Nazi concentration camp prisoners, come out with a picture of their beloved, those who fought or gave their lives for liberation of the USSR and Europe.
In Russia, Victory Day remains the most important public holiday of the year. It is equally revered in many of the former Soviet republics. The Great Patriotic War, which started for the Soviets in 1941, united the entire nation and still remains a centerpiece of Russia's consciousness.
Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Another point about knowledge-based production and response to this criticism is that should we make our production knowledge-based? We have actually raised the quality of working manpower who will embark on working in knowledge-based companies. Our educated youth. Today, a large percentage of our educated youth, whose population is large, are working in fields that have nothing to do with their expertise. They have given me a figure in this regard, which is very high. But because I myself have not pursued the matter, I cannot announce it here. Things are like this. This is a grave problem. This is, in fact, a kind of unemployment. A youth has gone through great trouble to study. The government has spent a long time has been dedicated to his studies, but they are not benefited from. This is a kind of unemployment. When we manage to expand knowledge-based companies, all these youths will be employed and the quality of manpower in our professional organizations will go up. Our outstanding personalities will be employed and they will no longer have to engage in occupations of less value.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One point that I deem necessary to raise about knowledge-based companies and knowledge-based production, of course, I have offered recommendations before, but I wish to add to them, is that there should be certain regulations for knowledge-based companies. It should not be the case that such and such a company, which is working by using a technology that existed 40 years ago, embarks on registering itself as a knowledge-based company, with the purpose of, for example, benefiting from the facilities and privileges given to them. This is not correct. A knowledge-based company must innovate in the true sense of the word. There are other qualities as well, which I will explain later. I could equally mention assembly companies and assemblers. Assembly is actually a kind of unnecessary importation in a different way. This is not production. This is not creating a product. Rather, it is merely a kind of importation. Such companies should not be allowed to register as a knowledge-based company. This is not correct. Therefore, there is a need for defining precise criteria and indicators for these companies.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Founder of Brazil's Workers' Party, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who served as president for two terms from 2003 to 2011, has launched his presidential bid as Brazil's October 2022 presidential elections approach. Economic recovery is his campaign's main promise.
We need to put Brazil back among the best economies in the world.
In an address to his supporters in the city of São Paulo, Lula called for unity around democracy. He also stressed the importance of focusing on Brazil's sovereignty and environmental issues. He criticized the performance of incumbent president Jair Bolsonaro, calling his administration incompetent. Bolsonaro faces a tough challenge to win re-election against his political nemesis Lula. The latest polls indicate that Lula maintains a comfortable lead over Bolsonaro. Many Brazilians are angry at the president's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, rising inflation, and high fuel prices. Bolsonaro has been widely criticized for downplaying the coronavirus pandemic from the outset, opposing restrictive measures for fear of damaging the economy. Over 650,000 Brazilians have died of COVID-19. Lula had previously described the huge COVID-19 death toll under Bolsonaro's watch as genocide. In addition, the government's fiscal indiscipline and the prospect of double-digit inflation have prompted the central bank to increase interest rates by 5.75 percentage points since March. Now, Lula says if elected, he has grand plans for Brazil's economy. One of them is to free the country of the US dollar. Lula da Silva has proposed expanding Latin American economic integration through the creation of a common regional currency. Lula says Latin American countries should use a unified regional currency like the euro to end South America's inclination toward the US dollar and to do bilateral trade with each other instead of having to exchange for US dollars. Lula has also vowed to revive the BRICS system, integrating Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa in an independent economic architecture to challenge Western financial hegemony. The five countries represent 41% of the global population, 24% of the global gross domestic product, and 16% of the global trade. Lula da Silva has also vowed to bolster Brazil's relations with other regional countries.
Now that's important because still the US dollar is used for the vast majority of trade in Latin America, and internationally still about 70% of international transactions are done with the dollar. What that does is it strengthens the US economy and it weakens other currencies. So Lula da Silva is saying, why are we continuing to do trade with each other using the US government currency? Why don't we create our own currency to do trade with each other? And I think a lot of countries in the region think that's a very sensible policy.
The Bretton Woods Agreement was negotiated in July 1944 by delegates from 44 countries at the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference held in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. Under the Bretton Woods system, gold was the basis for the US dollar and other currencies were pegged to the US dollar's value. Since then, the US dollar has dominated global trade and financial market. But now Washington faces a tough challenge, and that's to keep the crown on US dollar's head as the leading global reserve or fiat currency. For many years, the dollar has been the standard currency used in world trade. The US dollar currently has enormous power to infect the global economy with US inflation and the impact of US interest rate rises, both of which are managed primarily for US domestic purposes. Add to it the economic sanctions the US has imposed against other countries to achieve ends that complement or replace military efforts. Venezuela and Cuba are among the Latin American countries that have been victims of the US sanctions regime. One of the consequences of sanctions is rising inflation levels. Hence, it's natural for these economies to seek ways to circumvent America's sanctions. For instance, since 2011, China gradually shifted from trading in US dollars in favor of trade in yuan. It made agreements with Australia, Russia, Japan, Brazil, and Iran to trade in national currencies. It has been reported that in the first quarter of 2020, the share of the dollar in the bilateral trade between China and Russia fell below 50% for the first time.
It's an objective fact that the dollar is becoming less powerful over time. Even the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which is dominated by the United States, has acknowledged that the use of dollars in international central bank reserves has been decreasing. Now, it's decreasing slowly. It's not going to disappear overnight. But in decades, I think it's quite clear that the hegemony that we've seen of the US dollar dominating the international financial system is over.
Most economies are establishing different mechanisms to circumvent the US sanctions regime and the hegemony of the US dollar. These range from using barter trade to trading in their currencies over the dollar. The world is moving toward multipolarity, and the US is no longer the world's largest trading nation, it's China. Therefore, it's only a matter of time before the US dollar loses its dominance among global currencies.
At least three Israelis were killed and several others injured in the city of Eilat on Thursday in an operation the Palestinian resistance groups hailed as a victory for the residents of the occupied Al-Quds. The incident took place on the day of Nakba, or the Day of Catastrophe, marking the anniversary of Israel's eviction of Palestinians from their homeland and declaring its existence.
It was the event when 3/5, 40% of the Palestinian population was expelled or killed or expelled from their homeland, Palestine, and expelled mostly going abroad to neighboring countries and even distant countries.
The operation took place after over 600 Israeli settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound under protection from the regime's forces. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured, and some 50 others, including the elderly and children, were arrested during raid. In a statement, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas stressed that the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds is a red line and that the Eilat operation reflects the Palestinian nation's wrath over repeated Israeli desecrations of their holy sites. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement termed the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli forces and extremist Jewish settlers a declaration of war against the entire Palestinian nation, stating that Palestinians will continue to confront the occupiers and their aggression. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan has practically turned into a period of escalating tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. Israeli forces raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque culminated in an 11-day war between the regime and Gaza-based resistance groups in May last year, a conflict that killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. There has also been a recent surge in the number of Palestinian operations across the occupied territories over the past few weeks, raising fears that another war might be on the cards. The reactions to the mounting tensions have been particularly interesting. While many Western nations have kept silent about the developments, some, including US President Joe Biden, have been calling on both sides to avoid violence and exercise restraint. A parallel can be drawn with the war in Ukraine. Is anyone calling on Ukrainian troops to lay down their arms?
In a way, it's the same thing that is causing the United States to back the Ukrainians and to be against the Palestinians. It's the United States sees an advantage and putting pressure on a potential rival to its power, in this case Russia. They decided that Israel is the power that could help them to achieve that dominance. So it's all about in effect the United States ruling the world.
The normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel has made matters even worse for the people of Palestine, despite earlier promises that the establishment of relations would benefit their cause. The Palestinians have vowed to continue their resistance until their legitimate rights are acknowledged. If the developments over the past several decades are any indication, they will make good on their words.
The United States is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. That title means a lot of responsibility, as every permanent member is expected to remain committed to global security and collective council action. But the U.S. has shown for decades that it is very much ready to take unilateral measures to get what it wants. A case in point is America's sanctions policy.
The U.S. has gone outside the U.N. Security Council mechanism to impose tough unilateral sanctions against many countries. Even close U.S. allies may become a target of American sanctions. This is the Harry S. Truman Building in Washington, D.C. It is the headquarters of the United States Department of State. Many major U.S. economic sanctions programs targeting countries around the world are devised and enforced by politicians, diplomats, and lawyers who work here. From coercion and threats to financial punishment, the team does everything to make sure the sanctions are enforced. Perhaps the harshest sanctions ever imposed by the U.S. have targeted Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and the Russian Federation. America usually defends its sanctions policy, claiming that it is aimed at changing the behavior of foreign governments. But ordinary people in targeted countries have been bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The United States uses the sanctions as a form of hybrid warfare. It is a form of warfare, it's economic warfare, and it's a modern-day version of siege warfare. So you can imagine that the United States, without committing troops on the ground, uses sanctions as a tool in its arsenal for regime change and for pressure campaigns, both politically, militarily, and economically, on countries that do not kowtow to it, do not bow to it, and do not follow Washington's policies.
In Iran, the sanctions have caused economic hardship for people, among other problems. Iranian cancer patients, for instance, have been hit hard by the adverse effects of sanctions. That is because many firms, financial institutions, and banks, which are vital in importing medicine, have been blacklisted by the U.S. State Department. Iran has been targeted by some of the harshest American sanctions in decades. Washington refused to give Tehran any relief, even at the height of the coronavirus pandemic, when all countries needed much more financial resources to battle the disease. Although Iran has many years of experience dealing with such economic restrictions, a considerable part of its problems are being blamed on them. They have put a lot of pressure on Iran's economy, causing its currency to lose value and pushing up its rate of inflation to unprecedented levels over the past years. Iran's UN envoy has called on the world body's Department of Global Communications to intensify its efforts to inform the international community about the adverse effects of sanctions on the targeted countries. Addressing a session of the UN's Committee on Information on Wednesday, Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations said the use of the coercive economic measures are contrary to international law, international humanitarian law, and the UN Charter. Majid Takht-Ravanchi noted that the sanctions have undermined economic growth in the target countries and prevent their access to basic medical equipment and materials by blocking their financial resources overseas.
People can't have access to proper medical supplies, food, different types of technologies that are necessary. For example, aviation, you can think of transportation, things like that. Raw materials that are necessary just for basic industry and production. And overall, you see that there is a massive pressure put on the population in terms of their economic power to purchase consumer products because of the sanctions that are imposed. So it puts tremendous pressure on civilian population.
Iran has in the past described American sanctions policy as economic terrorism. Tehran says the U.S. is addicted to such coercive tools. Despite criticism from around the world, the United States does not seem willing to change course anytime soon.
outrage is rising in Spain over a hacking scandal. It has now emerged that more than 200 mobile phone numbers in the country have been hacked. The cell phones of the Spanish Prime Minister and Defense Minister were amongst the targeted numbers. Authorities have detected the Pegasus spyware in the mobile phones of Pedro Sanchez and Margarita Robles. Prime Minister Sanchez's mobile phone was breached twice in May 2021 and Defense Minister Robles's device was targeted once the following month. All in all, 2.6 gigabytes of information was obtained from the Spanish Prime Minister's phone during the first attack and 130 megabytes during the second, while 9 gigabytes were stolen from the Defense Minister. Spain's highest criminal court opened a probe into how the mobile phones of Sanchez and Robles were infected. Madrid has described the hacking as, quote, illicit and external attacks.
The illegal tapping of these phones has been proven in an ongoing verification that will reach all members of the government. We are reporting facts that are verified and reliable, not assumptions. These are extremely serious facts that confirm that intrusions have taken place in areas outside state institutions and outside the law.
The mobile number selections, believed to have been made by Morocco, occurred in 2019. Spain's socialist-led government is also under pressure to explain why devices belonging to dozens of people connected to the separatist movement in the northeastern Catalonia region were infected with Pegasus. The regional Catalan government has accused authorities in Madrid of spying on separatists.
So the Israeli Mossad has had a constant intelligence gathering operation against any client that is foolish enough to buy their materials. And this is being confirmed in the Spanish Prime Minister situation. So the CIA, the MI6, and the Mossad have always entertained a mutual intelligence sharing operation. And this revelation of the Spanish Prime Minister is just another example of that.
Pegasus is a malware developed by the Israeli technology and cyber arms company NSO Group. Unlike most spyware, Pegasus doesn't require its victims to unwittingly download it. Once installed, it allows NSO's clients to take control of a device to activate the camera and the microphone, see geolocation data, and read the content of messages. The company claims the spyware is used for counterterrorism purposes, but it's been accused of helping facilitate authoritarianism.
Well, the Israelis are notorious for the development of technology that they can sell to dictatorial regimes like Saudi Arabia, like United States, like the United Kingdom, as well as others. But they always install a back door as well.
There are now serious concerns within the European Union about the spyware. In 2020, a target list of 50,000 phone numbers leaked out and analysed by international media and rights groups revealed that the list contained the numbers of leading opposition politicians, human rights activists, journalists, lawyers and other politicians. In France, President Emmanuel Macron is believed to have been on a list of potential Pegasus targets. And UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been warned that his office may have been targeted in 2020 and 2021. It's now emerged that the phone of Jamal Khashoggi's wife was also infected with the spyware. Khashoggi was a dissident Saudi journalist who was brutally murdered in Istanbul in 2018. The European Data Protection Supervisor, the European Authority on Data Protection, is already advocating for prohibiting the development and deployment of espionage programs with capabilities such as Pegasus.
I think what we're going to see is the revelation that the Israelis are spying on everyone with the blessing of the United States, and you're going to see a departure from their technology and countries seeking more more solid, safe communication channels, such as that which is being offered by Russia, China, and India.
NSO Group has already been placed on the US blacklist. The decision reflects deep concern about the impact of spyware on US national security interests.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام يا ابن آدم ما كسبت فوق قوتك فأنت فيه خازن لغيرك.
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, O son of Adam, whatever you earn beyond your basic needs, you will only keep vigil over it for others.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is universal precisely because we can learn so many things from Imam Ali alayhi salam. When we say universal persona, we truly mean it because we find that these words of wisdom are not limited to just a Muslim. Matter of fact, any human being can take advantage of the beautiful words and the beautiful persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, this universality of the persona of Imam Ali comes about from this fact that he was connected with the Almighty Allah, the source of knowledge and wisdom. And so, dear friends, we live in a world which, unfortunately, because it has decided to go away and move away and refuse the commandments of the Almighty Allah, which is a prescription for perfection, because we have decided to move away and reject the commandments of Allah, we find that the world is full of oppression. Is this not so? Do we not see oppression from an individual level to a level of our families, to a societal level, to a national level, to a global level? You see oppression being committed, one human being against another human being. It is interesting, but along these lines, Imam Ali alayhi salam's persona, of course, was always in touch with the Almighty Allah. He says that there are three groups of people whose prayers are never rejected. One group of those people is the wronged person who complains to Allah because an act of oppression has been committed against them. And in return, Allah the Almighty will say, "By my honor, by my honor, it is incumbent upon me to help you, and I will take your right from the oppressor, even if a long time passes by." Dear friends, this is the importance and the value that Allah gives to an individual who is under oppression. And this individual who is under oppression is of such value to the Almighty Allah that Allah says, "I will take your right," meaning Allah will himself take the right of the oppressed person from the claws of the oppressor. And it might not be an immediate thing. It might take some time, but the Almighty Allah says that even after a long time has passed, "I will not forget, I will still take your right, the right of the oppressed from the oppressor." And so we too must be very careful that we do not become the oppressor, whether it is an oppressor against our own self, or within our own home, or amongst our friends and family members, or an oppressor in society. May Allah save us all from being an oppressor, and may Allah help us all from being unoppressed. A beautiful, profound, and truly thought-provoking lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالم على يديه يقول يا ليتني
كنت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
His name brings about a sense of strength in the heart. His remembrance is a source of inspiration for the souls. His legacy is widespread throughout the centuries and around the world. When we examine this phenomenal character, this individual that today we are not able to appreciate all of his qualities, and you know, they call us people who exaggerate who Ali ibn Abi Talib was. One of the scholars says, I was told, you exaggerate, you speak too much fada'il of Ali. You are someone who is excessively in love with this man. I said to him, don't worry, I am still at the A and I haven't yet gone further. He said, what do you mean? He said, don't think I'm still at the A of Ali. I am at the A of the alphabets of fada'il of Ali. No doubt you and I are not worried when people come and tell us, what is this association with Ali ibn Abi Talib that you have? Because we have understood his excellence. We have understood that through him is salvation. A man who was born in the best of places and martyred in the best of places and was martyred on the best of nights. A man who lived his life for the association of Allah and Tawheed. A man who gave everything for the religion of Allah. A man whose eloquence and bravery and wisdom and dedication is unmatched after the Holy Prophet. Why would we reduce as our association and our remembrance of this honorable individual? This association must continue and it must live on. Yet for us to strengthen that bond with Ali the Magnificent, Ali the man whose heart was full of love towards others, Ali who wanted his followers to follow in his footsteps in the best way. Those around Amir al-Mu'mineen recognize this. Salman al-Muhammadi al-Farisi, Radwanullahi ta'ala alayh, one day was walking behind Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen looks behind and he sees that Salman takes every step that Ali takes, exactly placing his feet. Look at that. And the way that those around Amir al-Mu'mineen recognized that this association is blessed. This association is the association of salvation.
قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
وقتی شخصیت امیرالمومنین رو بشناسه در مقابل او خضوع میکند.